Okay, it's time to get going. I want to ask to kind of remind everybody to turn off your electronics and all of the participants on the panel, if you'll make sure to speak into the microphone. And those of you, if you have questions at the end, if you come up and speak into the microphone so we make sure and get it on the recording, that would be fantastic. This is session 274, Author Meets Critics, In Heaven as It Is on Earth, Joseph Smith and the Early Mormon Conquest of Death. And I have to say that I pre-ordered this book. I was very excited about it and excited to get it when it came. So I'm just going to introduce each of our panelists in order of, as I have it on my sheet here, in autobiographical order, but
alphabetical
order. Thank you. Sorry. Kufre Ekpinyong was born in Baltimore. He is of Nigerian descent. He joined the LDS Church as a teenager and served a mission in Salt Lake City. He's now a sophomore at BYU, majoring in comparative literature. He is interned for Dialogue and Sunstone and has deep interest in Mormon studies. Russell Arvin Fox is an associate professor of political science at Friends University in Wichita, Kansas. And is there anything else that you want us to know about you besides that?
I'm boring.
And Samuel Morris Brown graduated from Harvard College in linguistics with a minor in Russian, then received an MD from Harvard Medical School. He is assistant professor of pulmonary and critical care medicine and associate professor in the Division of Medical Ethics and Humanities at the University of Utah, based at the Shock Trauma ICU at Intermountain Medical Center. And so I will turn the time over to our panel, and then we'll see how much time we have left for questions from the audience.
Who's going first?
Am I going first? Okay. That's fine. Rob, you know what to do. All right.
Okay. Sam Brown's written a brilliant book. That needs to be made clear first. His investigations into Joseph Smith's struggle against death allowed him to reveal a lot of interesting connections between disparate doctrines and declarations by Smith, all of which come together to illuminate much about the power and persuasiveness that Smith's restoration had in the early years, and to a certain degree still has today, especially for the lost, the doubting, the struggling, and the bereaved. Sam makes a fantastic case for seeing Joseph Smith as a religious genius in very much the sense that Harold Bloom declared him a religious genius two decades ago. So, I mean, that's the first point that needs to be made. The second point that needs to be made is that not all geniuses produce work that are equally appealing to everyone, and I'm actually not one that finds Smith's work, as it is considered and reconstructed by Sam, especially attractive, which became a real struggle for me. As I read Sam's book, I found myself impressed with the skill and the creativity by which he put together an argument about how Smith approached the problem of death and saw it as something that could be defeated by expanding the human footprint, by increasing the connections between human families, between human communities, between human individuals, by just growing larger and increasing. It's a powerful synthesis of what Smith provided, and it's one I don't like. And so, basically, as impressed as and admiring I am of the result of Sam's interpretive efforts, I actually kind of don't want Sam's account of Smith's struggle with the problem of death to be truthful, because if it is, then I feel even less attachment to Joseph Smith than I do already. So let me summarize my difficulties with the interpretation of Smith that Sam lays out. And maybe there'll be some point where he can say, hey, you got me wrong. And if so, I'll say, great, I'm a better Mormon than I thought I was. Smith struggled to build a theology and a society which would present itself as a route around or beyond the spectrum of death in antebellum America. And in reading through this, I felt as though I was reading about an entrepreneurial capitalist as much as I was reading about a translator, a seer, a revelator, and a prophet. In reading through Sam's analysis of Smith, I was reminded of the New Testament parable of the rich fool given by Jesus in the Gospel of Luke. This is from the New International Version. And he told them this parable. The ground of a certain rich man produced a good crop. He thought to himself, "What shall I do? I have no place to store my crops." Then he said, "This is what I'll do. I'll tear down my barns and build bigger ones. And there I will store all my grain and my goods. And I'll say to myself, you have plenty of good things laid up for many years. Take life easy, eat, drink, and be merry." But God said to him, "You fool, this very night your life will be demanded from you. Then who will get what you have stored for yourself? This is how it will be for anyone who stores up things for himself but is not rich toward God." Now, I do not want to imply that Sam presents Smith as attempting to outwit death through accumulating treasure. Nothing of the sort. But he does, I think, whether he intended it or not, present Smith as someone who saw the primary way of overcoming death as constant expansion, extension, and creation. That is, building bigger. Or at least, again, that is how I read this very fine book. I think Sam wants us to see the glory, brilliance, and revolutionary potential of the religious vision of Smith as one that turns on, more than any other single insight, upon the determination to make something more out of oneself and one's family and one's community, and then make even more on top of that. One of the primary interpretive discoveries in Sam's book, which led me to this reading, was his repeated insight into how Smith's religious vision involved a conceptual plane whose ideal was flat, unobstructed, undifferentiated, and open to expansion. Smith's speculative search through Egyptian hieroglyphics was, in Sam's view, a quest for pure language, an effort to recover that Adamic moment when linguistic barriers did not exist. In conceiving of the place of angels and resurrected beings, were pointed to the fact that Smith's vision was an ontologically flattening one, dispensing with the distinct orders of creation and the angelic hierarchies that existed throughout Christendom, incorporating all of creation in a uniform genealogical chain. Plural marriage, of course, is the most obvious example of what Sam sees as, or what he, to my reading, seems to present as an expansive and expanding mindset. Polygamy would destroy the exclusivity and the particularity of human relationships. Instead, making a heavenly family project which was outwardly focused, with the end goal being the transformation of individuals and families into a heavenly network of belonging. Smith's ultimate claims about the eternal destiny of human beings as gods themselves, following a progressive evolutionary pattern purportedly followed by our Heavenly Father, appear as a capstone to Sam's argument, as he writes in the second to last chapter of the book. Whereas other Christians understood a metaphorical kinship, Smith described an ontological identity, the literal connectedness of humans and God. Now, why does this sense of aligning, connecting, identifying, simplifying, streamlining, expanding, when one speaks of divine things, bother me? Not because necessarily I think it was untrue to Smith's beliefs. The truth of the matter is that even as someone like myself, who really can't go into all of the historical detail and interpretations that Sam provides, recognizes a certain consistent arc in the story that we tell about Joseph Smith. He really did move from seeing the endowment of power, for example, during the Kirtland era, as a collective experience with an ecclesiastical and consecrated community, into being a particular kind of infinitely replicable catechism, an individual rite that could be performed again and again, individual after individual, family after family, during the Nauvoo era. I should note that Sam, to his credit, recognizes that, possibly there's an element of paranoia kind of built into Smith's marvelously literal reading, as he puts it, of the idea that each and every one of us should and must become saviors upon Mount Zion to our family. And he suggests that Smith, if he had lived longer, might have been able to associate that particular kind of temple theology with a corporate vision of grace. But these might have been don't take away from the fact that as I read Sam's book, he kind of, in a head-shakingly admiring way, looks at the way Smith talked about how we as individuals must use our resources and our rights and our craftiness to liturgically seal ourselves up and lock God into acknowledging his promises to us. But actually, this isn't what really bothers me. I mean, closet Lutherans like myself have always kind of had a problem with the King Follett sermon and a bunch of other stuff like that. No, what really bothers me is that this reading of Smith makes me wonder what I, as a Mormon, actually believe about community. Now, Sam at one point comments that to situate Smith within Western political philosophy, polygamy was more Rousseau than Locke, more community than individual, more cosmopolitan than national. On the first two clauses of this sentence, I have no complaint, neither in one's interpretation of Smith nor in my willingness to associate myself with them. I personally think that Rousseau's understanding of our historical and social interdependence upon one another, for good or for ill, makes a lot more sense than Locke's defense of naturally grounded individual property and political rights. I think it is the community and not the individual which is the fundamental moral, economic, and psychological category which gives rise to language, judgment, and civilization. But then there was that last clause, cosmopolitan. There, I think something goes off the rails. Rousseau never defended cosmopolitanism, never endorsed the idea of universal human connections or rights. And the reason why he did it is because he recognized that community at most could be general. It could not be universal. There needed to be defined boundaries. There needed to be an association with particularity, with particular relationships, with a particular history, not one that can be expanded into an endless cosmopolitan whole. Now, to be clear, Sam surely does not mean in this one short sentence in a 300-page book, an excellent 300-plus page book, to turn Smith into an advocate of, you know, some utilitarian capitalist expansion and calculation model when thinking about God. No, he's not doing that. But then again, I can't help but wonder if in some small way, it isn't a very revealing sentence just the same. Sam insists frequently in the book that Smith's greatest fear was that death would disrupt human relationships, and consequently that his every effort to expand and enable connectedness between individuals was a way of strengthening human attachments against the grave. But what is the nature, theologically speaking, of these attachments so sealed up and redeemed and made godlike? The idea of ever-expanding connections between the faithful through adoption had been, as Sam himself carefully notes in the book, a widespread belief in antebellum American Christianity. For Smith, though, as Sam reconstructs his ideas, adoption becomes less a condition of grace than a tool of power, one that makes the universe orderly, domesticated, with our glory made dependent not so much upon God's will as upon our own efforts, an implication which one may derive from Sam's reading of Smith's reinterpretation of the parable of the laborers, who do not all receive the same wage through God's grace at the end, through the goodwill of the landlord, but rather are ranked on the basis of how much they've been able to get done. Smith's heaven apparently involved distinct kingdoms, but in Sam's hands we are persuasively, and to my mind somewhat frustratingly, led to understand our future destinies as simply a continuation of what we already know and already experience and already work to do here on earth. The transformation of the faithful through their adoption via Christ into the family of God becomes, in my reading, a secondary factor in the face of the idea that our being endowed with the authority and power to build up and adopt ourselves and others into families and connections is something that is simply based upon our own will and choice. The value and virtues inherent in becoming committed to particular families, connections, communities, to distinct orders, to having particular separate histories. And this traditional Christian understanding of all these particularities is remade through a higher understanding adoption into something rather different. Something that to many people may be profoundly appealing. But to someone who doesn't really care that much for a cosmopolitan, endless, expanding, unrolling, flat road, wasn't too appealing to me. So this ultimately is my take on Sam's wonderful, thought-provoking, and to me, slightly depressing book. That Smith's vision of the eternities and the future that we might enjoy with our families, thus escaping the sting of death, involves a community without particularity, without character, without limits, expanding like outlet stores and mini temples, and ultimately putting us on the same level of God and indeed on the same level of the rest of the creation. I have to simply conclude at the end of the book that I actually prefer my eternal communities to be characterized by a little Rousseauian mutual dependency and limited generalities, rather than a supposed promise of liberation that comes from being told that through the temple, we can always make ourselves more and always make something bigger and new. Hopefully, I'm entirely wrong in my reading of Sam's book, because if I'm not, then maybe I am not a very good disciple of Joseph Smith, after all. It's a great book, though. All of you should read it. Thank you.
Good afternoon. I'm happy to be here. I'll just dive in. Considering the question of how to respond to a book like this, many possible ways. Given, I guess, my background, I felt like the most effective way would be thematically. Speaking as a lay member, many people in the church have to give accounts of the church to those who are not part of the church. We have to explain doctrines to those who are not LDS. And I guess I chose to evaluate this book as an attempt to explain Mormon doctrine to those who are not LDS, and how it maybe would fit with other attempts, and how effective it could be for me personally and for others in understanding how to make sense of kind of the radical difference of Mormonism, Joseph Smith. So thematically speaking, one observer has attempted to explain the difference between Mormonism and other religions in this way. He notes that all Christians and all people of faith in general do hold a belief in life after death. Of course, many of the faithful speak of death as a journey to heaven, and hoping to succeed on this journey, all the faithful live their lives with disciplined and eager anticipation of the glorious world to come. But while many in the world do view death as a journey, this one observer comments that Mormons are the only people who are actually packing their bags for their journey. Perhaps this comment is actually true literally. When my non-LDS friends come to Salt Lake City for the first time and see Temple Square, they ask me why everyone is carrying around suitcases. Most Mormon households feature a temple bag of some sort. A temple bag is a literal bag of equipment and tools to help us along the eventual journey that is to come, the journey across the gate of death. It is common for religions to speak of death as a moment of transformation when the soul passes from earthly sights into the vision of sublime heavenly beauties. The soul is prepared for this journey when it is armed with certain virtues. According to Christianity, these virtues are faith, hope, and charity. In other traditions, we would speak of wisdom, detachment, peace, resignation, other virtues. Latter-day Saints share religion's general belief in the importance of virtue and ethical living. However, we also hold that there are tangible, physical tools that the soul must have in order to be successful on its final journey. These tools are large enough to perform the great task of salvation, yet they are small enough to fit within a temple bag. These physical reminders of divine fundamental truths give us an increased measure of peace, confidence, and certainty regarding life's greatest and largest unknown. As a convert to the church who has lived outside of Utah for most of his life, I often find myself explaining the doctrines of the church to perplexed and bewildered friends. These friends are often confused about specific issues where the church deviates from the Christian norm: polygamy, temple garments, deification, the physicalness of God, and so on. It is somewhat easy to explain the reasoning behind each of these doctrines and practices individually. And this is kind of one approach to apologetics. You would maybe approach Joseph Smith's life chronologically and just tackle each issue or question or problem as it comes up one by one. There is also, I believe, a second or more difficult category of apologetics. Here, it's not just about explaining the reasoning behind each specific doctrine, but kind of accounting for LDS outlook as a whole. You know, you can explain the weirdness of each particular doctrine, but the question still remains, well, why be so different in the first place? What's the purpose of these new doctrines? What was wrong with the traditional corpus of belief? Why is it so necessary for one church to separate itself from the world and to be so different from the other churches in matters of belief and practice? Many accounts of early Mormon history seek to progress through the history year by year or issue by issue, explaining our historical eccentricities one by one as they come up in the course of the account. Such texts speak effectively to the individual doctrinal questions that insiders and outsiders might have with regards to the LDS body of belief. I think that the strength of this book, In Heaven as on Earth, is that it attempts to speak to the project of providing an overall framing issue behind which to think of Mormonism as a whole. Mormonism, the book suggests, is a project to provide individuals and communities with greater certainty regarding the meaning of death, filling gaps of uncertainty that may have been left behind by the other theologies of Joseph Smith's day. I agree with this selection of death conquest as kind of an overarching issue by which to understand Mormonism as a whole. As a thematic connection between discrete individual doctrinal issues. It has been my experience, and the experience of other saints who I've talked with, that the doctrines of the gospel provide greater existential certainty by making the abstract more concrete and tangible. Perhaps, for example, a concrete God, a corporeal God, is more personable and therefore more easy to place trust in than a God who is without a body. Perhaps the sealing ordinance, where eternal family connections are literally and physically affirmed, makes it easier to believe that the family will be together forever, even though death appears to tear the family painfully and irreversibly apart. And perhaps the temple endowment, as a rehearsal or preview of the events that will befall us during the experience of death, wipes away man's greatest fear, bit by bit, year by year, through the power of repetition and reminder. Mormons are not the only ones who are actively preparing for peace during and after death. We are not, I hope, the only ones I know of who are literally packing our bags for the journey. We are, however, the only ones I know of who are Mormons are not the only ones who are actively preparing for peace during and after death. We are not, I hope, the only ones who will be able to successfully negotiate that journey. We are, however, the only ones I know of who are literally packing our bags, our temple bags, for the journey. The suits and suitcases on Temple Square will, for better or worse, continue to set us apart and make us unique among the religions of the world. And I just feel that death conquest is a strong, overarching, defining issue by which to understand the radical difference of Mormon doctrine.
I'm grateful for the opportunity to enter dialogue with such elegant and eloquent individuals as Russell and Kufrek. I'll start by responding to Professor Fox. I would first say that Brother Fox is in fact a fine Mormon. Likely a finer Mormon than me, or than I am. And if he found this book depressing, he should read my fiction. By way of broad contextualization for my response to what I understand to be
Russell's extremely spirited and intelligent misreading of my book, is to argue that it, at some level, Russell is doing exactly what all of us do and ought to do, which is reflecting on history in regard to the present. Not that we should write presentist history, but when we write good history, it should allow us to reflect meaningfully on the shape of our current lives. And the vision that he has of Chick-fil-A franchises disseminating across an identically configured world is, I think, in some respects, a reflection of his engagement of later developments in certain portions of Smith's disciples. The second thing is, I would tease just a little bit Russell about his use of the term disciple of Joseph Smith, because specifically, as I read Smith and his argument about the nature of relationship and salvation, it's not the question of whether you're a disciple or in perfect intellectual agreement with him. It's a question of whether you are committed to him as a member of his family. And I'd like to suggest in my response to Russell that the question at hand of particularity versus generality is mediated, I think, specifically in Smith's thought by the notion that the relationships we create as members of families are paradigmatic of the types of associations we can have, and in that regard can be separated from nationalistic or specifically perfectly uniform or uniformitarian models in a way that could be quite productive. I think one way to read Joseph Smith, and one way that particularly in the mid-20th century some Latter-day Saints did read Smith, was this sense of a Pelagian cowboy ready to take on heaven with the cavalry or some, riding some mighty horse of the apocalypse, storming the gates of heaven. But I think it's important to recognize that this question of what are the limits to human association, what are the limits to salvation, what are the limits to community, are in part Joseph Smith's grappling with what infinity means. We have Professor Peck here, who's written a very intriguing book called A Short Stay in Hell, that from the other side tries to grapple with the meaning of infinity, specifically an infinite punishment. Although it, as Dr. Peck, I think, will confirm, it teases a little bit the positive view of infinity as well. But Smith was trying to understand what it could mean for something to be infinite, while at the same time being constituted of people who have been finite at some moment. And I suggest, and here I will confess that my life partner has taught me much, both personally and intellectually on this point, it seems to me that the paradox Smith was trying to negotiate was how to create human beings that could love as God loves. For most Christians, including Latter-day Saints, God loved with perfect specificity. How often do we hear the heartfelt and tearful acknowledgement of the consolation that comes in knowing that God knows us as individuals? But that particularity, that specificity of God's love, is present simultaneously with the capacity of God to love every single human being, possibly even more than just human beings. So as we negotiate this question of particularity and generality, I would argue that Smith's belief that the familial relationship as a paradigm of an unselfconscious love, a love that arises from perceived identity, a love that is as difficult to disentangle from one's own being as that being itself, is a possible solution and a very productive one to the tension between particularity and generality. I think it's important to recognize too, and this was my project in the book, that Joseph Smith was entering into a conversation at the time with his American peers. Clearly, there can be many additional productive conversations between Joseph Smith and many audiences, but at the time he was responding to proto-Victorianism, to the rise of what we think of now as industrial capitalism in America, and to the complex waning of Calvinism at the time. So when Joseph Smith responds, he responds to those concepts and does so in a way that I think
maintains particularity. Now, Professor Fox also discusses the role of liturgy and sacramentalism, this notion that Kufre very elegantly evokes with this image of standing in a celestial airport with a temple bag packed ready to go. I think what Dr. Fox did not pick up on, and I suspect it's because of infelicities in my prose and the disorganization in my thinking, is that Joseph Smith saw sacramentalism as a freedom from anxiety and fear. There clearly are elements of much older traditions that gave sacraments their power, but simultaneous with those images was the possibility that through the temple you could stop worrying about whether you were elect, you could stop obsessing about whether you were backsliding, you could stop spending all of your intellectual and spiritual energy making sure that you somehow measured up to a particular vision of piety. And I have argued, I thought in the book, but I think more clearly in devotional contexts after the writing of the book, that in sacramentalism came not the capacity to joust God and knock him from his horse in the interest of gaining power over him, but to allow the mind and the soul to quiet from the ceaseless anxiety over one's election or regenerate status, and go about the work of creating family-like relationships with other human beings. Now, as far as cosmopolitanism, I confess that I thought I was being fancy by referring to Rousseau and Locke, whom Dr. Fox knows much better than I do. By cosmopolitan rather than national, I thought I was invoking the possibility that all human beings could be deserving of the same respect and the same prospects of salvation, and that salvation represented the creation of family-like relationships with people of great diversity. So I think, as I read Smith, and as I think about him now as a practicing and believing Latter-day Saint, that what Smith understood was not a perfect uniformity, not that Latter-day Saints in Tanzania would go to the same McDonald's on Monday and an identical church on Sunday, but that all of them could love each other in that complex fusion of particularity and generality that represents the way God loves. A final note on the question of particularity that I would contextualize with my great respect for Russell's great intelligence and powerful insight and broad soul, is that in a very real sense, in Joseph Smith's protest against the Calvinist heaven, he was making a strong argument for particularity. Remember that the theocentric heaven, which is the heaven that people associate with Augustine and Calvin and with Calvinism in America, was one in which all saved human beings worshiped God as individuals that no longer maintained the particularities of their earthly life. They were melded into the body of Christ. Joseph Smith, on the other hand, said, true, all will be united together, but they will be united as particular individuals. And their particularity, which supported the love, the family-like love they experienced in life, will be essential to the persistence of that family-like love, which he identifies as salvation. I have been perhaps strenuous in my response to Dr. Fox. In part, that is my way of apologizing. I would never want such a good person as Russell to feel dyspeptic about his faith community and his faith walk as a result of reading my book.
I feel that way on my own.
I'm not entirely sure what spiritual Pepsid would be. I suspect it is not reality television, having tried that once. Now I want to turn to Kufre, who I thought did a wonderful job of reflecting on the lived realities of Mormonism in the modern period. What do we do when we grow up in the eastern United States, or we grow up in Catholic Latin America, or post-Catholic Latin America increasingly? What does it mean to have arisen as an individual in Russia or Ukraine and then to become affiliated with or converted to or co-traveler with the Latter-day Saints, who are in many respects distinctive. Now, of course, in many other respects, they're not distinctive. But I think Kufra gets at this sort of question of what it means now to be a Latter-day Saint. And there have been important changes in cultural context, even in America, since the time that the Latter-day Saints were founded by Joseph Smith and his peers and colleagues in the 1830s. And specifically, there has been a substantial shift away from formal theology. Even people that are in traditionally fairly theologically oriented traditions have tended, particularly in America, although not exclusively, to move away from theology. And it can be very difficult to understand why exactly Mormons do things that were very explicit responses to Calvinist and post-Calvinist theology in the 19th century, when that no longer seems to be the case. When your interlocutor is dead and forgotten, what you speak may become more difficult to interpret. I'm grateful that Kufra recognized that I saw this book as an attempt to explain to outsiders what Mormonism was about. For whatever reason, I suspect it was being dropped on my head in Helena, Montana in the early 70s, I have a capacity to step outside of my own experience and think as another person might think. And I tried in this book not to approach Joseph Smith as a believing Latter-day Saint, which I am, but to approach Joseph Smith as someone generally sympathetic to the notion that human beings are religious, generally sympathetic to the idea that theological ideas could matter, and very interested in recovering the voices of those who were living at the time to the best I could in the context in which it arose. And I felt that that sort of an approach was the best way to communicate with outsiders. Clearly, this book is not intended as a missionary discussion or a proselytizing tool, because that was not how I sought to communicate about the Latter-day Saints. I wanted to understand them as a basically sympathetic, if vaguely secular, American interested in understanding history as it was understood then. And I think Kufra has a very useful insight about the capacities to communicate with outsiders that come from a piecemeal sort of checklist iterative approach to explaining our strangeness versus a narrative approach to explaining our strangeness. And I think there's reasonable data from psychology that human beings are better at understanding and remembering narratives than they are at remembering and understanding disjoint points. So I think there are even pedagogical reasons to prefer that approach. For me, I'm very interested in seeing connections. That's what I do. My day job is researching sepsis, and in sepsis I look for patterns and connections in organ function of patients with life-threatening infection, and I suspect that that has bled over to my history work, looking to see whether there are ways people might have understood apparently disparate notions as being interconnected. The only gentle point where I would push back against Kufra and in so doing push back against myself is as I've pondered the book and as I've talked to people about it afterwards, I realized that I may have underplayed the extent to which in the 19th century the question of death was a question of salvation. Clearly that's true. Clearly you're less frightened. I would think it's clear that you're less frightened about death if you anticipate perfect happiness than if you anticipate 1.3 million books. You should read Dr. Peck's Short Stay in Hell. It's brilliant and quick. Ironically, given that it's a meditation on infinity. Specifically, though, I would say that what seems to have wounded the Latter-day Saints, particularly in the early 19th century, was their sense that death represented the last moment to lose your salvation. And that's true in Calvinism, which was the waning but once dominant Protestant view in America, and that was true in Arminianism, which was the upstart response to Calvinism at the time the saints were living. And that brings me back to my engagement with Russell over this question of how the liturgy and the sacraments function. I really do believe, both with the historian's hat on and with the believer's hat on, that Joseph Smith was attempting to communicate the possibility that salvation could be a source not of stress and anxiety about one's worth or worthiness or commitment, and more a story about the love of human beings for each other and about the love of human beings for God and God for humanity. Thank you.
So if anybody has any questions, please come up and speak into the microphone so that we have, yes.
Can I actually respond?
Oh, sure,
Sam,
sure.
Ask
please
a couple do. Questions. Is this on?
Yes,
nope.
It is. So
is
go
it?
Right ahead.
Do the podium, man. Yep.
Make it formal.
Do
the
make
podium.
It official.
Make it official, Tom. Thank you, Sam. No, seriously, I mean that. I have a problem with sarcasm. But I mean that. The complex fusion of particularity and generality. I mean, that's a really fruitful and powerful, and to me personally appealing way to talk about it. So if that was in the book and I missed it, then you're right. I misread.
It was in an acrostic.
It was in an acrostic, right? Right along with Butthead. That is a really old joke. Anyway, looking at cosmopolitanism as a way of talking about people being united in their particularity. If you want to get into political philosophy, I could actually give you a better term to use than cosmopolitanism, but that's a different conversation. No, this was a great response, and I thank you for it. But I'm going to press you on two things where I really think I didn't read you wrong, and I'd like you to tell me how I did, or maybe tell me how those two things that I'm pretty certain I saw in your book fit into the response that you gave me. First of all, if we are to understand Smith's struggle with death as one that resulted in his idealization as the family, as a paradigmatic association, a union of love, didn't he ultimately, in moving the endowment into a mode of understanding where we see it as a right, as even a rather antinomian right, essentially posit a kind of endlessly replicable process, one that really, in the eyes of our eternal destinies, kind of consists of us departing from our existing particularity, ripping up our existing connections, and adding ourselves onto an ever-expanding new one. I mean, am I completely misreading that point? Because I thought that that was what I was getting from your book, that, that there was this move, from the Kirtland to the Nauvoo era, in the way that he thought about how these things were experienced. Secondly, in regard to sacramentalism, I like your definition. Sacramentalism is this, moving into this relationship with God where you don't have the anxiety, you don't have the fear. But I really thought that you were also saying that Joseph Smith, at the point where he was laying out his most advanced and esoteric doctrines, actually didn't really have a strong sense of sacramentalism. That maybe he was moving in that direction, but he didn't have it. And consequently, you still had that anxiety. Now, maybe it's not an anxiety over whether or not, you are one of the elect, whether you have been justified by God's grace, but it's a different kind of anxiety, an anxiety about separation. Have I sealed myself to my wife, to my husband, to my children, to my children's children, to my servant, to my friends? I mean, I'm going to be left behind. I got to get the sealing done. That's also a kind of anxiety. So regarding, whether families aren't in fact something that get ritually built up, possibly endlessly, and about sacramentalism, I'd like to get a response to you on those two points in particular.
Having deja vu, it seems like at some point in my life I've responded to Russell Fox about my book.
I'm endlessly wrecking this guy. In all places, at all times.
Russell is absolutely correct that there is a sense in which Smith's notion of liturgical sealing, the temple sealing, represents something with the capacity to replicate endlessly. It's not that you've misread. I think it's that you and I interpret in slightly different ways what I report Smith as having indicated. And I think something that will clarify that is to think through the current model of family relations, even the secular one. And the secular model of human relations, barring an ecological crisis that Dr. Peck tells me is just a few decades away, human generativity has the capacity to generate an endless chain of the generations. Each individual generation, two parents, I'm talking now just simply biologically, there can be more parents than two in a broader sense, but biologically, two parents and some number of offspring, each of those offspring have couplings with offspring in turn, and there's a geometric expansion of the numbers. Each individual link is consummately particular. It's hard to imagine a more particular relationship than parents and a child. But as that process of generation persists through the millennia of time, we go from 500, 5,000 early Homo sapiens to 7.5 billion to then 9 billion. And again, a nod toward a short stay in hell. 9 billion is an awful darn lot, and close enough to infinity that I think many people in Smith's time would have thought of a billion as approximately equivalent to infinity. So I believe that specifically the familial metaphor is crucial to understanding this creative and dynamic reconciliation of particularity and generality. With each link being perfectly particular, you can still end up with an endless network. Now, what I think you may be responding to is Smith's tendency to violate what others had thought of as the constraints on those sorts of relationships. It was now possible for people to jump from one biological chain to another. And that contest between biologically grounded family and sacerdotally or ecclesiastically grounded family is very important. And in some respects, the RLDS church that has become the community of Christ represented a response to Smith's legacy that emphasized biological. And the Brighamite movement that became the Utah LDS church represented that sacerdotal or priestly interpretation of family relationship. Now, as for that persistent anxiety that persists even in the face of the sacramentalism, I think that's one of the tragic elements of Joseph Smith's life. That as he continued to reveal these things that should have set his mind at ease, his mind was never fully at ease. And a non-Mormon historian that read the book before it was published helped me to recognize just how frequently problems that seem to have been solved 5 years before need to be solved again. And I think that's a testament to just how passionately Smith felt these risks. I don't believe that Smith was anxious about whether he could manage to get people sealed. I think he felt that sealing power would solve those problems on its own to the extent that it worked. But what was hard for Smith, I think, and hard for many, was to go on living after an assurity of salvation, because we know ourselves too well to believe that we really are godly. And that's for all of us. I think we recognize that there's something persistently human about us, even when a sacrament should have vouchsafed salvation to us. And I think I could have done a better job at openly recognizing the persistence of Smith's anxiety about whether what he had revealed was truly efficacious. Sir?
To what extent does the development of process...
I'll repeat it. You're welcome to the podium.
So I have two following questions. And one is, to what extent does the development of proxy work helped to mitigate some of the anxiety about having the sacraments completed. And, you know, when I read some of Joseph's writings about the revelation of proxy work, it seems that there is much peace and rejoicing in that particular aspect. And secondarily, is there a tension between this this need for some sort of final security and some of Joseph's theology around a God who needs relation and who risks and who is vulnerable to losing those relationships itself?
The answer to your first question is absolutely. When Smith reveals baptism for the dead, he's very clear that that implies that salvation will be available even to those who would not ordinarily be considered to have access to salvation. Your second question is absolutely fantastically difficult and beautiful, I think, and gets at some of the creative possibilities in Mormon theology. And I'll restate it in my own words, I hope, accurately describing your question. If salvation is relational, if salvation is a story about the connections, family-like connections, between divine human beings, and if Smith's revelations were a way forward that would relieve people of the horrible anxiety about the possibility that those relationships would be destroyed, how could it be that God could continue to participate in such relationships that may not prove durable? Right? The Mormon theomachy, the battle of the gods, the war in heaven, describes 30% of a lot who are no longer present with God. But if salvation is a story about relationships, how could that possibly be? That is not something that I have seen any evidence of Smith or the earliest Mormons working through. And I think that is likely to end up being a very fertile ground for musing about the paradoxes inherent in it. There's one way of describing the Mormon heaven that you've hinted at, which is it's a heaven that continues the deepest sadnesses of life. As I'm an intensive care unit physician, and I care for a fair number of people who have had very difficult lives, and many of whom have attempted to end their lives, and I meet them after a partially successful suicide attempt. And as I spend time with the people who love them, I recognize the wrenching anguish of someone you love harming herself or himself. And we're told that what we have to look forward to as we're adopted into the divine family is exactly that. We won't have bad knees, bad hips, pimples, but who the hell cares ultimately about a bad knee or a bad hip? What we care about is that the people we love suffer. That is what keeps us up at night. And my best guess from reading Smithian theology is we better get used to it, because that's what we're going to continue to do. And that has, I think, some interesting implications for what some people have called the emotional prosperity gospel. The notion that life is always about happiness, everything will always be cheery. And if things aren't cheery, then something we've done is wrong and God is providentially punishing us. But on this reading, and I'm going to admit that I'm not a theologian and have not been able to think this through theologically, what seems very likely to me is that we will be about the work of loving flawed individuals for all of eternity. And we may as well get good at it now. Not that we should ever wish suffering on anyone, but I think when we are providing succor to those who suffer and loving in the face of difficulty, we are doing what I think Joseph Smith suggested was the work of heaven. But that's a little hard. It's hard to persuade people to home teach, visit teach, church for 3 hours, not drink a glass of wine, not smoke a little marijuana, be entirely celibate until heterosexual marriage, to do all that for the prospect that in heaven we can have eternal sadness. Now, one could argue that the meaning of life is not to be cheerfully without no susceptive inputs, to be happily without any pain or anguish. It may be that the purpose of life is to be the types of beings that can love in the face of pain and anguish, and can love in a sacred way. The weeping god of Mormonism, that story of Enoch, that's early. Terrell Givens has started to argue, I think persuasively, that the earliness of that, the weeping god of Enoch, suggests just how early this radical and radically unsettling doctrine was present.
Sir.
My question has to do with the possibility that Joseph Smith was looking at the theology of salvation in his own teaching at first. If I read the Book of Mormon, well, I should say, the way I see the Book of Mormon, it said that once you are dead and you haven't repented, then that's it. And this was similar to the way the rest of Christianity was. And that within a short time, he began to see that that would not fulfill what he thought religion ought, true religion ought to be. So my point is that was he not trying to correct what the Book of Mormon was saying about this very issue?
That is a great and rich and difficult question. I would suggest there's the possibility that there are questions of audience and tone. There are certain messages that I think are very important to hear. And this goes back to debates with Universalists. The concern people had about Universalists, other than that they were heretical, was that they worried that people would no longer have any motivation to do anything good. And if you really do preach something, if you really do preach a message that it really doesn't matter what you do with your life, it'll be okay in the end, there seems to me to be a statistical probability that there will be people who will live sadder and emptier lives as a result of it. So it seems possible to me to read the Book of Mormon or other pronouncements emphasizing the need to get about the work of salvation in life as being compatible with an appropriate strategy to encourage people to live better lives. As far as the question of whether Joseph Smith explicitly felt himself to be arguing with the prophets of the Book of Mormon on this particular point, I've not seen evidence that he self-consciously did so. But I think it's an intriguing question, both of audience, intended audience, if you believe that the Book of Mormon describes people who did live a couple millennia ago, questions of audience for those individuals whose lives and teachings are described in the Book of Mormon, for people who believe that the Book of Mormon does not describe people who lived a couple of millennia ago. It could be a question about framing and progression in Smith's thought as he pondered these questions through. It has not been my impression, having been a teenager and met teenagers, that telling a teenager that no matter what you do, unless they've suffered some great tragedy, right? The typical blockhead, who with the appropriate encouragement will live a happy and productive life, ought to be told, you gotta do stuff right or you're going to hell. The person who has struggled with mental illness, who has had a difficult life, who has been through abuse, the message they need to hear is no matter what, God has a place for you. And I think that you could make an argument, perhaps, that there are some strategic elements related to the language that we use. And I think a child who has been free of psychiatric illness and abuse and is just a typical 15-year-old blockhead probably needs to have the message that you get your crap together or you got some trouble. But people who have suffered, I think, need to hear a very different message. And maybe that's a possible way to think it through. Sir, in the white shirt.
Comment and a question. Comment, your compassion as a physician glows through everything you say, so I would like to compliment you on that. One of the things, rather than talking about some of the lofty metaphysical kinds of ideas that we've been talking about here, one of the things that came through in the book that I had not given any thought to at all was the impact of Alban's death on Joseph Smith as a young boy. And so that was, in understanding who he was as a person, that was a profound new insight for me. The fact that you put all of those stories about Alban in there and gave me at least some view of what the impact of his elder brother's death was. The question that I wanted to ask was whether or not there's any evidence about the impact of the death of his first child.
First, thank you. I never wanted to be a doctor, but I felt that God wanted me to. And I didn't even want to be a doctor until I'd been out of medical school for 2 years. And since then, I've grown into it, and I do feel that it is a sacred privilege and an obligation to be kind to people as I provide the technical life support stuff. Thank you.
Very appearing in your book and
thank you.
Comments here today.
Thank you. As for Alvin, the scholar in me will confess that this is an argument that's been made by several others before. The arrogant scholar in me will say I did a better job of it than people that came before. But the emphasizing Alvin is not new to me. But I tried to think it through a little more thoroughly. Now, as far as the question of the role of Smith's firstborn, to be honest, I can't remember whether I put this in the book. I may have. But he was, so a necronym is when you name someone after someone who has died. And necronymy was very common in prior epochs, and we still practice it today. It tends to be, a grandmother that's been gone, or a grandfather, or a great-grandfather that's been gone. And now we think of it generally as honoring the memory of someone. But earlier generations of Atlantic human beings believe that necronyms actually had some sort of a metaphysical power. And there was a sense in which the use of a necronym would identify you with or bestow upon you special access to the legacy of the decedent and some of the promises to the decedent. And although because the child was stillborn, it was never officially named Alvin, I think there's good evidence that the intention was to name it Alvin. And there's even some, I think, reasonable evidence that Joseph Smith anticipated that his firstborn son, Alvin, would be his older brother's heir spiritually in some important way. But Alvin died, if a retrospective account is correct, died about an hour or two after being born with congenital deformities. And this happened crucially while Joseph Smith was pondering his error in releasing the early manuscript pages. It turns out the Joseph Smith Papers Project have instructed us that it wasn't 116 pages necessarily. That was based on a later pagination, but it was a collection of manuscript pages. He felt like he'd done the wrong thing. He'd given it to Martin Harris. Martin Harris was gone. He hadn't heard anything. Emma's in childbirth. Emma almost dies. Out comes a baby that's deformed. The other thing to recognize about that history is there are things called monstrous births. Monster comes from the notion of showing, like remonstrance, or in Spanish, mostrar, comes from that root to show. So a monster originally meant a communication or a showing by God, and generally it was a showing by God of his dissatisfaction. And monstrous births were also something that was very important. You'll remember Anne Hutchinson gets in a fight with the stuffed shirts. And then, God bless her, this prophetess has a stillborn deformed child. And David Holland, who's written a wonderful book about canon in early America that Oxford published called Sacred Borders, I hope I can remember his turn of phrase, through a stillborn child, a God who no longer spoke indicated that he could not speak through a prophetess, or something like that. That Anne Hutchinson already was fighting an uphill battle against Massachusetts Bay Colony leadership when she had this stillbirth of a deformed child. That was finally proof positive that she was a heretic. So for Smith, there's necronomy, which is some sort of metaphysical association with his lost brother. Then there's the weight of the monstrous birth and the recognition of his sin in giving the manuscript pages to Martin Harris. He rushes to Palmyra, discovers that the manuscript pages are gone, and almost has a mental breakdown. And when you read Lucy Mack Smith's reminiscences about that stage, about him crying, you've always thought, oh, you know, he felt bad that God was cursing him. But piecing together the time frames, there was a lot more going on. And there was the very distinct possibility, in fact, probability, that in Joseph Smith's mind, his boy Alvin was taken monstrously in that old sense because he had given the manuscript pages to Martin Harris. It's a very sad story. Sir.
The experience of death, the frequency of it and the manner of it, was very, very different in Joseph Smith's day than it is in our own, at least in the developed world. And this seems to be continuing to improve. We may foresee, you know, a few decades in the future where life expectancy may be greatly enhanced and death may be even less common, less frequently experienced than it is currently. And I'm wondering if you have any sense for whether this kind of reading of Joseph Smith becomes less relevant for us today and in the upcoming few years than it was for him.
That's a great question. The sad demographic data are that there's a possibility that this generation will have a shorter life expectancy than their parents, which is something we in the United States haven't seen for a century, related to primarily the diabetes and obesity epidemics. But your point is a valid one. Is Joseph Smith's vision relevant today when most of us no longer die at an early age, and hopefully will die less and less commonly? My current project, not about Mormonism at all, is called The Lost Deathbed. And what's happened is I've given talks about the book to non-Mormon audiences who don't give, you know, a rat's patooky about Mormons. They're all fascinated by this question and have stories and concerns and questions about the possibility of dying and our utter incapacity culturally to accommodate the fact of death. So I'm beginning to argue in the book, and I'm joining my voice to a chorus of voices like Ira Byock and Daniel Callahan and Timothy Quill, that in fact the message is very important now. I don't think we recognize just how heinous death has become for many people, because even if we get the median lifespan up from its current 78, 79 for women, 75 for men, to 85, 95, say we get a median lifespan of 95, another 20 years, the mortality will still be 100%. Right? Regardless of how far along we are, when the angel comes to call us home, by Jove, we will die. So I don't think we need to spend as much of our time understanding why women die in childbirth. It's much better for them to survive childbirth than to die in childbirth and have a cultural way to accommodate it. But we still all will die. And because that is true, We need to have a way to confront it and to make of that period of our life when we exist in the precincts of death meaningful and powerful and emphatic of community. And I would argue, and do argue in the new book, although I won't talk about Mormons at all, because I'll be pitching it to an entirely not even a particularly religious audience, that we need that vision, even if you don't call it Joseph Smith's vision, we need that vision as we continue forward. And I actually don't want to live to 95. My wife might want me to.
You heard of Kurzweil, who is aiming to live forever?
Kurzweil is the researcher that's been looking at mitochondrial stress and privation diets.
Yes.
Yeah. I would think that Joseph Smith would respond to Kurzweil that he has lost his mind. In order to minimize mitochondrial stress, this is based on the notion that our life is measured not in years, but in the number of calories burned, because every calorie you burn induces a certain amount of stress on the mitochondrial machinery. And they found that if they starve rats, they live much longer. And this Kurzweil guy lives, I think, on 900 kilocalories a day. An average person here would need 2,100 to 2,400 kilocalories a day. If you ask him what his life is, he walks slowly to the car, he drives to work, and he sits down. And 8 hours later, he walks slowly to the car, and he drives back to his home where he sits down. You cannot survive on 900 kilocalories a day and have a full and rich life. So I think Smith would say, you missed the point. You live 20 extra years of languorousness, of stuporousness. And the point is to love passionately and powerfully with the recognition that the stay against the prospect of our own death is the power of the relationships or the strength of the relationships that we create. Now, I have a competing interest, which is that I eat more than 900 kilocalories a day and derive great satisfaction from it. So if you're wanting to be fastidious about it, it doesn't appeal to me at all to starve and to move very slowly and do no exercise and eat no good food. Sir?
I ask this question. Why do you think, because it's probably historically accurate, but why do you think Jesus was the first Jew to get the idea that death was the enemy that needed to be conquered and not Israel's enemy? I guess the person who wrote the book of Daniel also had the same idea. Why does that come so late in the Hebrew Bible that death is really the enemy that we want conquered, not the nations that are taking our treasures?
The question is, why does it take mid to late Second Temple Judaism, Jesus, and the two centuries before him, why does it take until, I think historians suggest, why does it take until then for Judaism or for Israel to see the main problem of salvation and deliverance as not their liberation from national oppression, but their liberation from their own personal deaths? Why does it take so long? The first caveat is that, as a hobby, I'm an 18th and 19th century intellectual historian, which has almost nothing to do with being an ancient Near East scholar. So what I will describe to you is the functional equivalent of a Time magazine blurb on this topic, not rigorous scholarship. The argument goes that it's been exceedingly common throughout human history to envision the afterlife as an afterlife of muted existence, muttering spirits, Sheol, the hell of the Hebrew Bible, and Hades, the hell of Greek antiquity, were places of shades, of ghosts, of spirits. And if you look in the anthropological literature, about other traditional societies. It's very common for the large majority of the dead to be personalityless shades or ghosts. And the current argument, except there's that guy at Yale, John, it's not John Butler, it's a Hebrew Bible guy, John Levinson, maybe? John Levinson is arguing against the status quo in biblical studies. The status quo in biblical studies has been that personal resurrection does not exist in Hebrew thought until it's imported from Persia, 4th century before the Common Era. John Levinson has argued that that's wrong, and in fact you can see these tendencies earlier. You know, who's right? Some dude from Yale fighting against everybody else. Who's going to turn out to be right? I have no idea. It's likely the case that they both have overstated their respective cases, and there were some in the Hebrew community that believed it before the importation of Persian beliefs, and that Persian beliefs were nonetheless an important way to think it through. You are correct to observe that the Book of Daniel and the traditions around the Book of Daniel and the Maccabean Wars are associated with the notion of personal resurrection. There is an argument by, he just passed away from Columbia. Oh, crap. He was a Jewish religious historian, life after death or afterlife. I've forgotten his name. He died about a year ago from Columbia, very productive. He made the argument, and others have agreed with him, that this first becomes acute during the Maccabean-Hasmonean War, when they had to think through what happened to the martyrs in the war. That's when particular individuals sacrificed their lives on the altar of the nation to protect it from the foreign, the Goyim invaders, and that personal resurrection first became thinkable as an account of what happens to martyrs in the Hasmonean War. Now, I don't read the full literature to know how well that's been received, but my sense was that it told a reasonable story. And there are arguments that it really catches on in Christianity, again, because of the martyrological pressures. But I think you can't say that death must be conquered meaningfully until you believe that there's a possibility that there could be some persistence of your human intelligence after that. So it may be that it's a conversation that didn't make sense. But that's, again, that's U.S. News and World Report level reportage. That is not any kind of scholarly statement.
Well, it sounded rather scholarly. But the thing that puzzles me is that death hits us all. Ever since the beginning of time, it's death that people are afraid of, the end of their life. It's why we measure time. It's because it's limited. We all have limited things. I'm trying to figure out why in all these religions isn't the brutal reality that's faced like it is in your book.
But there's no doubt that it was a brutal reality. The question is whether they understood that there was a possibility that they could persist beyond it. It was feared, it was negotiated, it was argued with. But at the end of the day, they'd never seen anything except, you know, too gross, you guys are going to go have dinner, never mind. They'd seen things in nature that suggested to them the possibility of disembodied forces, winds or particular noises or fires, and they may have associated that with the only possible manifestation of humanity afterwards. It's an interesting set of questions. In the interest of eating, participating in life, I propose that we adjourn. The benches have told me that they have several copies of the book that you're more than welcome to buy from them. On that note, I want a round of applause for these two extremely elegant and intelligent